me down. Oh, but if you miss.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you all with us here on the Mark Steiner Show. And we're going to cover a number of topics here. Of course, we've heard the tragic news that Governor Larry Hogan was diagnosed with cancer. We'll talk a bit about that at the very top. Mayor Stephen Rawlings Blake is now president of the Conference of Mayors and gave a speech calling for the Baltimore Compact, which we'll be talking about what that means. She has said that the city will not allow the funding of reopening of liquor stores in Baltimore City that were burned during the Baltimore uprising. That's caused a huge controversy between she and the governor and the store owners themselves and the Korean Store Owners Association that owned 100 of the 180-some stores that were burned, and we'll talk about that. And, of course, the continuing battle between Mayor Stephen Rawlings Blake and the Fraternal Order of Police and what is happening with our police in the city of Baltimore. And we'll get your thoughts on those and many other issues at 410-319-8888. The mayor has jumped into the fray along with others saying we should ban the tags that have the Confederate flag on them for Maryland vehicles. And many want to see Robert E. Lee's name, that name of that park, change to Lake Rowland, which has been proposed by Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz. Your thoughts at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. And you can also get on our Facebook, tweet at me at Mark Steiner, but call 410-319-8888. So let's talk first, and we want to introduce our guests. Your ship is in the house. Once again, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist in residence, an associate professor of journalism here at the Global School of Journalism at Morgan State University. Phil Tran is in studio, political consultant and CEO of Phil Tran Public Relations. Good to have Phil and Ship in studio. And one more guest is arriving soon, Dave Von Love from Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and you at 410-319-8888 to join us here. So the news of Governor Hogan and what he announced at that press conference yesterday was pretty stunning. Made stage 3 or 4 in his non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. People can look at this politically, but I think mostly it's just wishing him the best. 18 weeks of chemotherapy that he's.
I think that's what we've seen. I saw a lot of outpouring of sympathy on Facebook and Twitter this morning, and I think that is the case right now. People are not looking at politics. Setting aside some of their rivalries and sending him best wishes.
Hearing the news was just absolutely devastating. I know for me in my personal life, I've known far too many people in recent months who have been diagnosed with various forms of cancer. And just to hear that Governor Larry Hogan is now battling cancer of his own, I know exactly what he is going through. And he's going to need a lot of faith, strength, and support from all his family, his friends, and the entire state of Maryland and across the country in order to come through this. And I'm a firm believer that victory is a team effort, and I'm pleased to see that everyone is coming together hand in hand to wish Governor Hogan the very best.
Yeah, I think he has a very tough road ahead of him, 18 months of chemotherapy. This is, and if he's actually in stage 3 or 4, he has got a real battle ahead of him, and I think we all just wish him well and the best. And somebody wrote to me this morning asking me to speculate on the lieutenant governor becoming governor. I think it's not quite right to do that politically or humanly at this point.
But the governor did touch upon that subject.
He did.
Yesterday in his news conference. So he is saying and assuring people that the state is in good hands. He intends to be able to guide the state and to pursue the agenda he was elected to pursue. But he said that he has great faith in the lieutenant governor. He's already giving him lots more responsibility.
So we will see how this progresses for him. And there's not much more to say about that. And we'll just wish him well and hope that he heals. 410-319-8888 is the number. Join us here. Let me go right to the phone. Somebody's on the line from 695 and hopefully on a not on a handheld phone. But John, welcome. You're on the air.
Mark, always a great show. Thanks for having it. Hey, observation. The term uprising is being used a lot to discuss the troubles in Baltimore.
Yes.
And that offends me. You know, I, when I think of uprising, I think of the post office, Dublin, 1916, the Easter Uprising. I think of Nat Turner's slave rebellion. I think of serious political and physical, you know, uprisings. I kind of consider the Baltimore events, as I've seen them, as just kind of, you know, crazy lawlessness. And I'd like you folks to I'm not discounting any of the frustration and whatnot that lays behind it, or any of the structural stuff that lays behind it. But for me, uprising is a pretty special word, and I don't think it's applicable here. So what do you guys think?
Okay, good. That's one of the reasons I got you on, because I saw what you wanted to talk about. I want you to let you have that out there so we can respond. Go ahead, Phil, then we'll go over to Ship, and I'll give you my 2 cents in a moment as well.
Yes. The frustrations behind the Baltimore uprisings, so to speak, in this instance, are very real. Let's not discount them one bit. But in a way, I do see your point, because if you do know American history and you go very, very far back, there have been true brutal uprisings that have required military force, full use of military force to suppress them. Let's talk about the Whiskey Rebellion. The Whiskey Rebellion that happened in the 1790s that was the result of the federal government's imposition of a tax on whiskey. Whiskey farmers who depended on whiskey for their livelihood in western Pennsylvania started a real rebellion. And it required President George Washington to order military forces to come in to western Pennsylvania to quash the rebellion. Now, when you talk about the Whiskey Rebellion, then you compare it to what's happening in Baltimore. Obviously, the level of involvement from the government definitely is disparate. But that goes to say that we still cannot discount the real problems and issues that are being brought forth by the citizens of Baltimore through their actions and their responses to what's happening.
Ship?
Yeah, I don't like the word uprising, but not necessarily for the reasons you suggest. I just think it doesn't quite get at what happened on the streets in April. Some of these historic events that we refer to often had a little bit more organization behind them, or there was some particular goal in mind. What happened in April was more of an outburst of frustration and anger that was not necessarily targeted at any particular goal. Some people who became voices of that event in April had agendas that they began to try to shape around what had happened in the streets. But I think what happened in the streets got ahead of the usual leaders who come forward to talk about the underlying concerns of poverty, joblessness, police misconduct, et cetera. I think some of those who were in the streets torching buildings and throwing rocks were angry at a lot of things, but they were not necessarily organized in such a way that we saw a movement developing from it.
410-319-8888. And I'll quickly say to John that I do want to talk about some of the issues that the mayor has brought up and where we think this is all going. But I use the word uprising on purpose. It's a political reason I use it, that it was the frustrations of poor people in the city, poor black people in the city, working class people who have had enough of police brutality, poverty, violence in their communities, and erupted to take on the state. And the state, the only thing they can take on at that moment was the stores that were in front of them, as opposed to the state itself. And that's why I use the word uprising.
I understand.
As I did
that.
From 1968, I used it in 1964, and I'm going to use it now in 2015.
But some of the circumstances were probably different in each of those occasions. In any case, whatever the word is, I think we shouldn't get away from the issues that were underlying and that are forming part of the mayor's Baltimore Compact that she's now trying to get national leaders to focus on. How do you reassign resources to address these issues that have not become the priority that they should be? not just in Baltimore, but around the country.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. How does that work? And then we'll go to our next caller, Kadri, your next one up at 410-319-8888. But I do want to jump into this, she's now the head of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, talking about that every city has to face these economic issues and issues around race and police. And so, but I don't know what that means right now. It's a fairly amorphous statement. So what do we think that means for us?
I don't know if she knows what it means. It sounds good. and I understand the notion that you jump on the situation while it's hot. So now the attention is focused on what happened in Baltimore and some other cities since Ferguson, at least. So I don't know that she has an agenda. It's like we're still trying to figure out what One Baltimore means. That was the initiative announced right after the uprising or riot or whatever you want to call it in April. But I don't even think that's fleshed out. We know that there are really entrenched issues, but I don't see that her saying that we now have a Baltimore Compact is going to necessarily push us towards anything in terms of having the urban agenda being a major agenda for our politicians in Washington.
You say there's no agenda, and I can see that no agenda may possibly be a good thing, and let me explain. Because if you go into a project without having any preconceived notions of what the solutions will be, perhaps it will allow you to be more open-minded as to what solutions to implement. And if we're going to combine all the knowledge and the resources of all the mayors across America to help tackle the major issues that are affecting all American cities. We have so many cities across the nation that are dealing with the same issues in many different ways. So as a result, we should be open-minded and try to pick the best ideas from the best people and then apply them to our own situation.
I think that's right, but that organization has been around for a long time, and they've been articulating these same issues for a long time.
Forever.
So I don't know that this is necessarily going to mean anything new. It sounds good, and as I said, attention has been focused on some of these issues because of what happened here in April. So now may be a time to maybe get Congress to do something they wouldn't have done earlier, but I don't really see there's a magic bullet out there.
And it seems to me that yesterday we had Congressman Cummings and Congressman Billings, with the head of the Congressional Black Caucus, and Congressman Maloney from New York on this program, talking about the meeting they're having this morning in Baltimore to address that. And as I probe them with some questions, whenever you talk to politicians about this idea, there are no concrete ideas about what to do that are any different than they've tried and not done in the last 50 years. So, I mean... That's this great rhetorical flourish, and the mayor will be on the show Monday. At least she's booked to be on the show this Monday, and we want to kind of probe that a bit. So, I mean, what I'm curious what our listeners think need to be the things that you want to hear from our elected officials about what this means to change the nature of the city at 410-319-8888. I know there's a group now in McKeldry Park on the east side of town that have done this huge study they're going to be coming out with on all of the housing, who owns it, who owns the abandoned housing, who owns the abandoned lots, with a proposal to do a community land trust so the community might control the land and develop it inside the community. That's what I'm talking about. Debating ideas that we're not talking about to change the nature of communities and giving people work.
That sounds good, but has that plan been put out before, too? After the 1968 uprisings, for example, we saw a lot of these similar kinds of urban, I don't want to use renewal, but urban redevelopment plans were put out there then. I don't know the answer. That's not my specialty, but I do know that we hear this language over and over and over again, but we don't really see any sense of urgency among those who have the power to put something in place.
The other phones were turning out to go to Phil at 410-319-8888. Kadria, you're on the air before we go to break.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, everybody's talking about the frustration. The gentleman, a speaker before, said he doesn't see it as anything but lawlessness. No one has said a word about the hurts and the pain that we have suffered for 400 years in this country under the same system with the same garbage going round and round like a spinning wheel. What would be happening right now if we was killing up their Caucasian boys the way they are killing up our boys. I want you to ponder that and ask your panel that and ask them, do you think that would be lawlessness?
Well,
and last thing, the riots. I've never in my life seen a riot anywhere in the world that didn't involve looting and burning. That is the riot.
Right. I think that we've addressed your first question a lot in this program. I mean, I think that that is what we're talking about here. I mean, what are the ideas to address what we're facing in this city? What should the mayor be talking about? What should we be talking about? We can't keep saying the same things over and over again. And what we're going to commit to.
And somehow the things that we're saying, that we're talking about, don't seem to necessarily reach the people who feel the most hurt. I was reading something from a young reporter at the Afro newspaper who's been talking to young gang members, for example, and getting them to talk about what the problems are. And they don't see any connection between these policies that we're seeing being announced and in some cases being executed. They don't see any connection to their own lives of any of these things that our politicians are talking about. So we're hearing the same speeches over and over again. We're seeing some programs being put into place, but they're not necessarily reaching those who need them. And that's what we have to change.
And to the lady that just called expressing her frustration over 400 years of oppression, that's something that I believe we all sympathize with. I do have to point out, however, that we do have to give credit to the resiliency of the African Americans in our nation, because despite all the oppression that they have experienced for many, many, many years, here in America today, we have an African American president. We have successful black business leaders, successful black entertainers, athletes, philanthropists who have overcome enormous odds to be successful in America. And it's very important to know that despite all the frustrations and the difficulties that some people may be experiencing right now, there's always hope, and there's always hope that we can always accomplish great things.
Well, let me go to the phones here in just a moment. Leroy, the next caller up at 410-319-8888. Hold on for just a second. I'll take a very brief ID break and come right back and pick up your phone call and then jump into the question of the police in Baltimore City, FOP, the police department, and more. 410-319-8888 is the number here. On our way out of here, not a way out of here, on our way to break, I should say, we're listening to Eddie Cochran, Three Steps to Heaven. Hit number one in the stand 1960. 3 months later, he was killed in a car crash while touring Britain. We'll be right back. And things do go wrong. Just follow.
We got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout.
Welcome back. Ship and I were just talking about country music and the blues, and there we have it. That's Johnny Cash
and June Carter.
There you go. Jackson is the song. June Carter Cash passed away on this day in 2003. In honor of her, we played that piece of music. We are here with E.R. Schiff, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist in residence here, an associate professor in the Global School of Journalism at Morgan State University, and Phil Tran, CEO of Phil Tran Public Relations, and you, 410-319-8888. And Leroy, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I was just talking with some of the young guys this morning in West Baltimore, and we were saying how scary it is when all you hear about is there's no solution to the problems, and that mainly because of the uprising back then, there was a lot of frustrations that came out. But there is a solution, and one of the things is coming to the community and teaching. You know, we have to learn how to take care of ourselves, you know, and it's gotten to the point now where that's what we do. I teach some of the young guys around here how to cook. It's a small place up there called Art Social.
The Art Social Club on Pennsylvania Avenue and North?
Correct.
Yeah.
We was at Ground Zero. And, I mean, even now, on Fridays, some Saturdays, we teach the guys how to fry fish the proper way.
All right.
Chicken, vegetables, you know, how to dice it up. If you teach someone how to feed their family, they feel a whole lot better as being a woman or a man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't teach a person to read and write, because everybody don't have the resources to learn, you'll still keep having what we're having. One of the things that bothered me about our congressperson, Elijah Cummings, was I found out that he sponsored a youth group, a youth center in Israel. I don't have anything against Israel, don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But he's here. He represents us. And we can't get any recreation centers nowhere in this community.
Now, not in defense of Elijah, though I do know, I didn't know if he sponsored a place there, but I do know that he sponsors this trip every year with a Jewish organization to take African-American children to Israel. And even in that, he doesn't kind of they don't take the trip over to Palestine and see all sides of it. They only go to Israel. But I didn't know about that part, and I will check that out. But I'm interested in come by the Art Social Club and see what you all are doing, teaching cooking. I'd love to see that in action.
I'd love to eat the fish.
and I think those things are important.
I agree. I've been talking to people too about. A lot of people don't understand the connection between being involved in civic life and in changing their lives. And so I was chatting with some people recently and saying, you know, back in the 60s in Mississippi, when people were pushing voter registration and such, they had freedom schools. And that was a way to actually bring some real life skills and practical information to people who didn't necessarily get it. Maybe we should think of some versions of that now, is to go into the communities and work with young people and not so young people to help them to reconnect.
And I do want to applaud our last caller, Leroy, for taking action to help improve his communities. And we can be legitimately frustrated with the inaction from our government officials, but that doesn't take away from the fact that we have the power to shape our own communities and set our own course. We are currently broadcasting live from Morgan State University, a fine institution of higher learning, an HBCU that, like many other HBCUs in the 19th century, was born out of the frustration of black people with their inabilities to get admissions into institutions of higher learning that were, at the time, whites only. So, yes, you do have the power to create your own institutions, create your own programs, and help improve your own communities.
So let me get to, before we go to Clarence, our next caller up at 410-319-8888, Clarence, going to come to your call. But let's talk about this battle over whether or not the city should allow the state or the city should help store owners who were burnt out during the uprising, the liquor stores, to reopen. This is a huge, this is a really important discussion to have. It's beyond just opening and not opening stores. I mean, it goes to the heart of a lot of the issues facing these communities.
You know, this is an instance of social engineering that's been done before, that you use an opportunity to transform an area in a way that you think is more socially productive. A lot of people are upset that when you go into some of these neighborhoods, all you see are liquor stores, churches, and funeral homes, it seems. And, of course, some fried chicken or lake trout joint. But I kind of agree with what the mayor is trying to do. She is saying that if the city is going to provide economic assistance to any enterprises, then those enterprises should be doing something that's going to benefit the city. I realize that that's probably going to harm some people who are not prepared to change from running a liquor store to changing to run a grocery store or something else. But I think I support what she's trying to do.
I would actually disagree. I do see what Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake is trying to achieve here. However, you have to understand that the liquor stores are owned by regular people, small business people. Many of them are minorities, African American. A lot of them are Korean Americans, and they are just trying to find a way to support and feed their families. We're not talking about Bill Gates here. We're talking about a family running a family-owned business, running very small margins, probably scraping by with 20, $30,000 a year, but they're making the sacrifice because they want to have the freedom, they want to have ownership in a business, and that's what they've been doing for many, many years, and it's very, very difficult to just try to come in as the government and uproot these families and tell them that they got to do something different, they got to move somewhere else.
Well, they can, if they want to remain in business, they can do it without the government support. They have that choice. And so this is saying that if we're going to put government money, in this case city money, into something, we want it to benefit the city in the ways we've determined, we, the city government, has determined. So I think that's okay. Now, the zoning laws changed a number of years ago, as I understand it.
They did.
So some of these businesses are hanging on only because they were there before, or some business was there before, selling liquor. Times change. I think there are options for those people who are struggling, as you said, to maintain a small business. There are some options. If they were to sell something besides liquor, there are a lot more options for them, even from the city and state entities. So I don't think it's being unfair. It is looking at what's best for the city as a whole.
I mean, let's see what our listeners are thinking. I mean, these are real questions. I mean, I guess I might push back a little bit. I mean, having grown up in a family where some of the cousins and other people I knew owned liquor stores, the marginal profit in liquor stores is huge. It's not just a little thing. I mean, people make a lot of money on selling liquor, whether in bars or by the bottle or can. I mean, and the question is, what right or role do communities have to say what businesses they want in their community? And if they have insurance, then the store owners can do whatever they want with that insurance money. But if their insurance is covered all and they expect the state or federal government or city government, state or city government to move in, then there is some room for negotiation about how the money is going to be spent and what gets sold or doesn't get sold and what's needed and what's not needed. And, you know, I mean, that's if a hotel opens a business, they're going to say, this is what I need in my hotel. Does the community have the same right as that hotel owner to say what's inside their area? I mean, that's the question.
I think that's what this whole discussion will be. And I hope it remains at that level and that it doesn't become accusations that the city is going after Korean merchants or something like that. You saw that after 1968, there was a sense that there was a black versus Jewish fight for economic control of some of the neighborhoods.
Right.
We don't want to
right.
revisit that, but I think there is a rationale for placing conditions upon how the city's money is spent in terms of helping small businesses.
Let me go to the phones here, 410-319-8888. Get your thoughts. Clarence, you're on the air. Then we'll go to Ricky. Clarence, welcome.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner. Mr. Steiner, in the conversation about in the resources and putting money into communities and things of that nature, those are funds that are coming from a source. What we're really talking about here, when you get down to it, we're talking about the shifting of economic resources. We're talking about the redistribution of wealth and jobs and salaries when you get down to the basic, to the bottom line of it. And somebody's going to have to give up something in that fight, and nobody wants to give up anything. You cannot say, you cannot force Wall Street and the controlling element in this country to say, okay, we're going to redistribute wealth in the form of jobs and salaries over here and take them from there. It just doesn't make any sense to me, given the control structure that we have. And I'm not going to say structural racism, but there's a control structure there. So, you know, when you talk about this, we're talking about the redistribution of wealth, income, and economic resources. Now, how do you make that happen on a massive level enough where it has an effect, a positive effect on the people that we're talking about who are, you know, lagging behind, so to speak? And as far as education is concerned, Mr. Steiner, you know what? I make CDs. Not music CDs. I will copy Adobe 3D Max with tutorials from MIT and everywhere else and put it on the CD. Here, kid, here's a CD. You know that game you play? There's a program in here that'll teach you how to make one of those games and all the math that you need. And everybody that knows me know I carry these things around. So, you know, I don't wait for anybody else to teach anybody. Here it is.
Right.
It's free. You know, thank you, Mr. Stein. I'm just going off.
Now, Clarence, always good to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening, always being a consistent caller. Good to have you with us. Let me. Dave Von Love is joining us by phone. He's one of the other guests in this program. Dave, I'm good to have you with us, man. Glad you made it.
Hey, how you doing, Mark?
I'm very... So, weigh in on this question of liquor stores.
Yeah, I mean, I think a part of the frustrating thing I think about, you know, the way the liquor store is set up is that it's an agency that is controlled by the state, you know, in many ways. And so a part of the problem is that in terms of having direct effect on, you know, the ability to set policy in that regard, you know, our local elected officials are kind of, you know, we don't have the kind of power over, you know, to talk about a liquor board, you know, that we would need to be able to actually, you know, really have control over it. I think that's a part of the problem. And that's one of those kind of, you know, the minutia of how the law works and how the different, you know, agencies are set up, that I think it's important for people to know as to why there's issues with it.
And I wonder is what it would mean. I mean, it seems to me it's more than just saying you can't open. If you had a way, A, of helping to bring black-owned businesses into the black community, B, if store owners are going to come back, is there an incentive, a way to help people build businesses and not just focus on liquor, but are focused on laundromats and cleaners and food and other things the community would use, as opposed to, it seems to me maybe this is an opportunity for a plan to reinvigorate.
That sounds like what they're inching towards. There is a whole small business and minority-owned business mechanism in place here in Baltimore, and one would think that this is what they're doing in telling people, we're not going to give you this money for you to continue running a liquor store, but we do have money available for you, and we do have opportunities for you to be to receive some kind of training to upgrade your skills in operating a business. I think that's what the small business and minority-owned business people are doing.
Phil, let you jump in, but let me get to the phones here. Let's see. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Ricky on line two.
Good evening to one and all.
Morning, Ricky.
I support completely and fully Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake contention that businesses, and usually there is a great many small businesses as well as some large doing businesses in urban communities across our city. I support the notion that they should contribute in terms of giving something back of the 99.9% revenue that they get solely from our communities. I think it's a novel idea to go to associations like the Korean Merchants Association and other cultural associations to ask them to contribute to the very sources that support their efforts at commercial enterprise. So I'm in support of the mayor and her belief.
Good to hear from you, Ricky. Let's go to Terry and then go back to our three guests here. And then I'm going to switch gears here and talk about the FOP and the city police and what they want to know and don't want to know. 410-319-8888. Terry, on line five.
Hello.
Hi. Is it Terry or Larry?
No, it's Perry.
Terry. Go ahead, Terry.
It's a Perry with a P.
P. Got you, Perry. Sorry, Perry. Go ahead.
You know, I've been going around the Baltimore City. Now, somebody on the panel said that minorities, I guess it is minorities running the stores in the black community, but it's not black people. Might be a few black people here and there. I don't know where they are. But I don't know. I just think, like, anywhere where a large number of black people dwell, you know, I think it needs to be something done about this. You know what I mean? Maybe the officials, you know what I mean, here, you know what I mean, that we all be voting for could do something about it. That the black people could run every major area every major activity of those areas. You know what I mean? I mean, for something simple, you know what I mean, like a gas station. You know what I mean? We need help with these things, like a gas station. You know what I mean? Supermarkets, just simple things, so that we can employ ourselves. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, we don't want Korean people or Arabs or whoever. You know what I mean? Running liquor stores. I mean, the liquor stores are just destroying black people, destroying the black youth. you know, in order to feed themselves. I mean, they can open them up where they dwell. How about that?
But
good morning,
Perry. Thanks so much. And Ship, and let's go around the room. Go to Ship, and then Phil and Dave on, kind of, and then get another caller in.
Well, there are a lot of things being said there, but I think that the initiative to start a business should come from an individual. That should not be the government saying we need this, this, and this in a particular neighborhood. So if an individual decides he or she wants to have a liquor store or a furniture store or anything else, that comes from a person. And that person then needs to make sure that they have the proper training, the proper support system to be able to operate this business. I don't think we need to say that we want to have government telling the Korean Merchants Association they need to give back to the community. Just by operating a business, they are giving to the community in that sense. So I don't go along with that. But I think that we shouldn't determine who owns a business based on their race or ethnicity, but we should make it possible for anyone who actually wants to have a business to be able to do so.
Phil?
Yeah, I mean, yes. One thing I'll just say really quickly, I think...
Dave on them, Phil, I'm sorry. Dave on.
You know, as if you think about the kind of economic, situation that black people are in Baltimore and around the country, I think there's something to be said about looking at the fact that the reason you have so many stores that are owned and operated by people outside of our communities is the kind of, the fragile economic position that black folks are in. And so I do think that there's a role in thinking about what are the implications of having folks who aren't over from the community operate those stores, because it creates this kind of strange tension where, now you have a community that's dependent on wealth and income, from our communities in a way that is, I think, detrimental. It's almost as if, their economic vitality is dependent on the extent to which they can engage in the kind of exploitative, practices, commercial practices. And so, I think it's important to disentangle that. And I think there is a role for government to play in looking at what are the implications of a certain type of financial economic arrangement on the communities most directly affected.
I want to say that I agree with everything that ER has just said about businesses. The initiative for starting a business has to come from an individual. It can't come from the government. Additionally, businesses exist to serve a demand. So if there's no demand for a certain product, then that business cannot exist. Now, when we're talking about liquor stores, I do feel a little bit uncomfortable on the topic, mainly because I do agree that there's really little benefit in and of itself of just serving liquor to the community. And so far, everybody pretty much agrees that liquor has been a scourge in the community and has used a variety of arguments to support that point. Interestingly enough, these were the same arguments that were around across the nation in the early 20th century that ultimately led to the prohibition of alcohol passed by a constitutional amendment. And that constitutional amendment needed to be repealed about two decades later because the prohibition of alcohol nationwide caused a lot more problems than the alcohol itself originally did. So therefore, when we're talking about getting rid of the liquor stores in a certain community, I'm not a fan of liquor. I don't drink. I don't think anybody should partake of that personally. But when I think about the unintended consequences that may come down the road, it makes me a little bit leery, admittedly.
And I will admit I do partake. And, but I also think that there are questions, Dave, on the way back to the phones here, where of demand. Sometimes the demand when it comes to the marketplace is not driven by those who want to buy, but driven by those who want to sell.
Right, and the free market isn't completely a neutral framework. The free market is also, impacted by, what are the conditions that the community is in terms of its relationship to the demand that it produces. And so I think there's a difference between, demand where you have black people in an economic subordinate position, where they don't have the same, the same level of access to the kinds of business loans or the same access to, the kinds of, supports that, you know, or even just, you know, relationships with, you know, elected officials, you know, and the kinds of things that business owners do in order to make sure that they can protect their businesses. You know, so I think that there are a whole range of things. And when you have an economic arrangement that's, you know, that's kind of produced by the free market that creates detrimental effects financially and otherwise for a community, you know, this isn't to say that you try to control what people buy or the demand. But, you know, and I mean, you look at the federal government gives subsidies to all sorts of things, you know, agriculture, et cetera, you know, industries that they think are important given the financial arrangement, you know. And so I think similarly, there are moments when government interventions are important when you have a context where much of our wealth is being extracted and leaving our communities. That's just not a sustainable financial arrangement, and I think it's important to at least be conscious of that and thinking about ways that the government can help when the demand in a certain context is detrimental to a community.
Let me open the phones here and get a few calls before the end of the hour at 410-319-8888. Glendora, quick thought from you. Welcome.
Hi. How are you?
Very well.
Okay. I am in agreement with the mayor as far as not giving money to you know, those businesses that are a detriment in the black neighborhoods. And as far as the liquor stores are concerned, it seems that that's where you find all of these little shops and stores, and then there are a lot of other problems that come along with it. Now, if they want to stay in business, then they need, whoever's running it needs to find some other type of business, one that will help build up the neighborhood and to lift the people up, rather than making it easier for people to be involved in things that are actually destroying not just the families, it's destroying the city.
And I think those arguments have been going on for as long as I've been living in the city, which is my entire life, just about, except for the years that I was gone. Let me get one quick call in here, then I want to get some closing thoughts from our guests. And let's go to Jada. Jada on line two.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Jada.
About the liquor stores. How come we can't have liquor stores in the Korean neighborhoods or in the Arab neighborhoods?
But there are no there are no Korean or Arab neighborhoods.
Well, in other neighborhoods other than our own. Every other neighborhood, and I've seen ethnic neighborhoods, we have liquor stores two or three a block, along with the churches and the hair stores. We haven't even spoke about them, okay? These people walk around the store behind you like you're going to steal as soon as you hit the door. So that shows you the contempt they have for you and what they think about you. And we still go and participate them like we have nothing else to do. They do have a Little Italy. They have a place where a lot of Orientals live. You don't see one black store in there. We don't have a toothpick factory in this country. And Mondawmin was a wake-up call that these people will watch us starve if we don't try to do something for ourselves.
So let me just close this way and answer all of you to comment on this. Maybe this is an opportunity. We didn't get the police, but that's fine. We'll do that another show. But maybe this is an opportunity for us to both reclaim communities, build new businesses, put some effort into building black businesses and reaching out to the Asian American owners of businesses in a black community to try to create a new way of doing things, Davon, rather than doing the same old thing we always do.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, if you look at, you know, I mean, a part of, you know, what we had in our communities, you talk about post-civil rights, was a mass disinvestment from the institutions that operate in our community, the mass exodus of resources from our neighborhoods. And I think, you know, there is some responsibility on our own communities to be intentional about building institutions that are self-sustaining, that provide the kind of economic wherewithal for the community. But I think it's important that, you know, the government, that government entities, you know, the mayor, you know, and other elected officials are conscious of the extent to which their policies can help facilitate that development, whether it's financial support, whether it's technical support, but providing the kind of resources necessary and that level of investment that can encourage people to organize business in a way that would be beneficial to the neighborhood.
And maybe this is where the compact can begin, some different way of thinking, Chip.
Possibly so.
Right.
I think a lot of these pieces that you've laid out are happening, but maybe this is an opportunity for more coordination of those things. As I said, there is the city touts its efforts on behalf of small businesses and minority and woman-owned businesses. We also have various entrepreneurship training programs going on around the city. And there are business associations of various types that are aimed at pulling together resources for training, for technical support, and also for philanthropy. So maybe this is something that the Baltimore Compact can include, and that could be maybe the focus of what the Mayor's One Baltimore also does, is just pull together all these things that are already in place and make them work more efficiently towards the goals that we just articulated.
And final thought, Phil Tran.
Yes. Obviously, there are many, many issues that we need to tackle here. And I do believe that one of the best ways that we can raise up our communities is twofold. We need to be able to empower small businesses and create jobs, and we also need to be able to have a strong educational system and educational opportunities for our youth. So, therefore, let's be open-minded about the solutions in that front. We want to train people to start businesses. We want to train people to have jobs. We also want to make it easier for people to set up businesses, ease their tax burdens. We want to have people go to the best schools. Why should anybody be locked into a poor performing school just because of their zip code? Let's try to find a way to make sure that all of our kids get the best education as possible. Let's work together to make Baltimore a much better place, a place that it can truly be.
I'm going to thank you all for being here. Do we have time for this one last caller? Yes, no? No, we do not. I'm sorry. But do write us here at talk@steinershow.org or steinershow@gmail.com. Give us the thoughts you couldn't get through on. There were ideas about alternative businesses and alternative ways of economic development, which we're going to be talking about a lot on this program in the coming months because we have to come up with ways that don't do the same things over and over again that fail. So we're really going to be exploring that in some depth. I want to thank Phil Tran, first time on the program, CEO of Phil Tran Public Relations. Good to have you with us. Dave Von Love, Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, co-author of the Black Book, Reflections from Baltimore Grassroots, and E.R. Shipp, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, now journalist in residence, and associate professor in the Global School of Journalism here at Morgan State University. Thank the three of you so much for taking your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On our way to break, before we talk about the Pope's encyclical on the environment and more, and meet some filmmakers at the end of this hour, it's Careless Love by Ray Charles from his album Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music, hit number one on this day in 1962. Enjoy. We'll be right back.
Was blind, but now.